It's a party. Good tunes, good brew, good buddies. I feel great, man. I feel great! I don't know, man. I hate my father. I hate my life. But I feel great, man. You guys are great. I'm gonna go pick a fight.
TBTL.
Where am I?
The pit of despair. Don't even think.
Don't even think about trying to escape.
Oh, okay. Ooh, well, so you want to do it the hard way, huh?
First, I want you two to turn and look at each other. Oh, now that's nice. Just stare deeply into each other's eyes. Yeah. Good. Now say the first thing that pops into your brain.
I don't want to touch sandpaper.
I like the whiz. It's party time, chumps.
All right, hello, good morning, and welcome, everyone, to a Wednesday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
It's unique. It's bold. It's ahead of the competition.
My name is Luke Burbank. I am your host.
I am extraordinary.
Coming to you from the Nest Broadcast Center, perched high in the sky above Portland, Oregon, where we are looking at a beautiful day out there, my friends.
California got sunshine.
It's going to be warm. It's going to be sunny. It's going to be a great day in the 503. And this is a great show. It's episode 3,446 in a collector series.
Let the fun begin.
Tell you, we have got to get on this NFT train. There's a New York Times article where the writer declared it to be an NFT. And it sold. First, I thought it sold for like $350, and then I was like, well, that's sad. But it was like 350 Illyrium coin, which was like almost $900,000. Anyway, now the first line of code from the internet is being auctioned off by Sotheby's as an NFT.
It's called the internet, and it's a fresh new way to check out sites, buy clothing, and surf music.
So we will tell you what's going on with that. Also, Crawdads, a.k.a. Crayfish, apparently act more boldly and take more risks when they are on the antidepressants that we are all urinating out into our streams and rivers.
I feel happy of myself.
So we'll take a look at what's going on with that. And we'll do some emails and V-mails, and we will talk to this guy, the longest-running Cobra of the show, maybe best known for his depictions of the tall ships, and also for making that sound effect. He is Andrew Walsh. He's joining me right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Good morning, my friend.
Good morning, Luke. Then I say something. There's a skit in Mr. Show which ends with somebody. It's somebody's turn to talk, and they don't know what to say. So I believe it might be Sarah Silverman who just yells, and then I say something. And that's kind of an ongoing joke in my house. Genevieve and I will sometimes throw that at each other when we drop the hacky sack. And I got to say, I just dropped the hacky sack at the beginning of the show. I don't have a bon mot for
you. Do you feel pressure? Like, I know you're usually kind of doing a couple things, last minute stuff, maybe dashing off an email or two. But like when I say good morning, my friend, does that moment generate stress for you?
No. Nine times. I almost feel like it's like 11 times out of 10. I have too much I want to tell you at the top of the show. For some reason today, though, I feel like your intro might have been a little bit shorter. My brain was just like floating somewhere. I don't
blame
know.
The victim. Sure.
And now, well, here we got something we can talk about if you want. Theo will not settle down today. This is, of course, my 16-year-old roommate. No, just kidding. It's my 20-year-old cat. Theo is usually I can calm him down before the show, sit him on my lap a little bit, and then get him all purring, and then set him down on this chair. He will not settle down today. Here, he's coming back onto my lap. This is the content that nobody asked for. Theo's on my
lap.
Can
I tell you about
quiet.
My elaborate sleep routine these days?
Yes, what's going on?
Well, as the listeners know, I am on the side of this apartment building that where the sun rises and hits this side of the building, and that seemed like a cool thing when I was living here in the wintertime because it was nice. It was like at around, I don't know, 7 a.m. or so. It got light. It's kind of a natural nature's alarm clock. So I would leave the shades up, and it was sort of pleasant. But it is now, I swear to God, the sun rose at 5:30 this morning. Is that possible? Can that be a time
it feels
that the
like
sun
it.
Rises?
It feels like it's light in the bedroom all the time now, and it's kind of annoying me.
I'm trying to Google what time was sunrise.
Can I
in
guess?
Portland.
I'm going to guess it happened at 6:15.
5:21 a.m.
Whoa, you were so much more right.
So, and also it's warm. So I have to like do, I also like to fall asleep with the blinds up, with the shade up, because, you know, if I'm going to bed and it's dark, it's twinkly outside. It's, I don't know, it's calming to me. It's a pleasant experience. I don't like to go to sleep with the shades drawn. Drawn means down, or drawn means pulled back.
Wow, good question. Hey, draw the shades. We're going to do something sketchy. Yeah, I think
Amelia Bedelia. They said draw the shades, and then she drew a picture of the shades.
Oh.
They said put out the lights, and then she just put all the light bulbs outside, I think.
She sounds like a real pain in the ass.
Yeah, horrible ratings on TaskRabbit, Amelia Bedelia. But anyway, so what I have to do to fall asleep, or rather to sleep in the morning now, is I have to at some point in the night remember to wake up. Usually my bladder helps me with that. Then I have to go and I have to pull down the curtain. I have to make sure that the fan is on for noise purposes, but then also the air conditioning is on for coldness purposes. But I don't like to have the AC on when I'm falling asleep for whatever weird reason. Then I have to make sure the closet door is closed because there are big windows in the closet and that will light will stream in through there. And then I have to make sure that my sleep mask is placed right over the top corner of the headboard so that I can reach up at 5:21 a.m. when all this is going on and put on the eye mask as well. And if I miss one of these steps, I'm up at 5:21 a.m.
The thing that drives me crazy is when the coffin lid isn't quite tight and the light comes streaming in. This morning I had a moment where, and again, it's this light that's messing with us. And I know, you know, I'm not complaining about, you know, the summer weather and the daylight, but it is like in our bedroom, we have big windows on two sides of the room, and we can't keep them all covered because of, I don't know, complications with the curtains that we have. They are drawn, and they're literally just drawn on the windows. We hired somebody named Amelia, and honestly, yeah, the Yelp review of a lifetime is what I love.
Honestly.
Anyway, this morning I woke up with a start about 7:30. Now, here's the deal. You and I dial up at 9 a.m., ideally, I'm out of bed by 8. Ideally, I'd be out of bed at 7:30, let's be honest, or 7 or 7:30, but I'm always pushing it to about 8. This morning, I woke up with a start because it was so bright in the room that I had that that distinct feeling that one gets when one oversleeps. Now, I was actually thinking about this morning. I don't think I've ever just straight up overslept for an episode of TBTL. I mean, first of all, we don't do it that late, but like that feeling that I have not had in years now, when you have a job where you have to wake up around, I don't know, like something more respectable, like 5:30, 6:30, you know, and then get in a car usually or a train and go to work, like that more typical kind of work schedule. That feeling, I imagine I've done this at least once for every job I've had where I just missed the alarm, right? And that feeling of you're rushing to work, but you know you're going to be an hour late. You've either missed the morning meeting or, you know, everything is already in progress at work and you're going to be like running in disheveled. I don't know. Maybe adults don't do that. I feel like I've done that in my 20s and 30s. Now, this morning, I woke up with that feeling. Yet I have not slept, you know, overslept for a TBTL, I think, ever. But it turns out it was just 7:30 in the morning, and it would have been the perfect time for me to use that energy that I had, that jolt of electricity that went through me. I should have gotten up. I should have gotten my first cup of coffee, maybe jogged around the apartment. I don't know what people do. But instead, I just went back to sleep and set my alarm for 15 minutes later than it usually would so I could get some more sleep. So that's
And you were able to fall back asleep.
Sort of, but not well. It was one of those things where again, like, every decision was wrong because I wasn't getting any, I wasn't getting anything out of this. I was just being stubborn and didn't want to get out of bed. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, outside the door, we have Theo just car alarming it up because he wants to be fed for like hours. He's on my lap right now. We got Banana scratching at the door because she wants to be fed, but she's not as loud as him, so she scratches at the door. That's all great. So I put the pillow over my head, and I'm just trying to snatch little, like, a minute of sleep here, a minute of sleep there. I just refuse to get out of bed, but I'm not getting anything out of it other than me dropping the ball the moment you said hello to me on TBTL this morning, which wouldn't have happened if I had gotten up earlier and gotten into some
adventures.
Don't
you think the deepest sleep is in between hitting snooze on your alarm?
I actually think it's the lightest sleep, but it feels like the deepest sleep because that's where we dream. I don't know if I'm right, like, but I don't. I'll have nights where I toss and turn.
By the way, while you were talking, I was tweeting parenthetically, leaves scathing Yelp review for Amelia Bedelia. We'll see how that one does. I feel like I will sometimes toss and turn over the course of a night, and then when the alarm goes off and I hit snooze, that. I think it's 9 minutes on my iPhone that my snooze is set for. I will go comatose in that 9 minutes, or at least it feels that way.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, if I can actually get to sleep there, it can feel sort of refreshing when I wake up. But again, that's where the dream time happens. And we've talked a lot about dreams on the show lately. I'm not going to try to drag us back into that because I feel like I've repeated myself quite a bit lately on that front, especially. But I don't know. I know that it can sort of feel like, 'cause if I wake from a dream that is very vivid, I think I will feel more rested because I will. I think I stand by this because I feel like I was taken away for a long time. I was living almost in a different universe or something, and now I'm back in this world, and I feel like I was well rested during that time. But usually those dreams happen during these times that I think are actually lighter sleep. Again, like in the morning between alarms, the light is shining in, the cats are crying, but you're just like trying to get 10 minutes of sleep. I don't think that's heavy sleep, at least for me.
Maybe I'm just living in a different situation here in Portland because it's just me and Randy. But when you were talking about oversleeping, that's a terrible feeling. Now, the listeners will remember a notable time I overslept on the floor in my house in Bellingham, which led to a year of not drinking for me.
Oh, yeah.
But short of that, I think that might have been the only time I've ever literally slept through this show. But I do remember when I was on the newscast unit at NPR. So I was doing this kind of internship thing where I was loaned out to the newscast unit. And I had one job, which was to come in on time and write news copy for, like, Corva Coleman. And I decided to go to still what I think is one of the best-named bars in America, particularly for D.C., Filibusters.
That was a good name.
Which was in, I think, the Holiday Inn, like in sort of near 7th and Mass. I went to Filibusters, and I made friends with a cab driver, and we went out and toured the town. In fact, he took me to his brother's, like, Ethiopian restaurant, and we had, like, all this great food, and we drank a lot of Heineken, and we were up until very late, and I must have just not set my alarm, and I woke up, Andrew, and I turned on the radio, and Corva Coleman was doing the newscast.
Oh, no. Oh,
and I knew that was when he knew he had effed up. And that was the worst, because I was, like, probably there for, like, a week or something, and it was a terrible, terrible, like, sort of first impression to make with everybody. And I remember, another time I was supposed to do the traffic on the weekends. Turns out I have a lot of stories, Andrew, about sleeping through my shift. I was supposed to do the traffic on Metro Traffic on a Saturday morning. I think I was supposed to come in at 5 a.m. and relieve a guy named Kevin Eby. And I had been in Vegas with my friend J.J. Tebow, and we had been up for days and playing blackjack, and a fire was lit in me. And so when I got home, it was so much fun, and when I got home, I beelined it for the Tulalip Casino, which in those days was in this pretty small, smoke-filled building, not anything like the fanciness that we'll be enjoying on the 3rd of July. But anyway, I beelined it for the Tulalip Casino. This could be a sign that, you know, I have a problem in that once the Kraken was released in Vegas, as soon as I got home, I was like, I should probably go up there and spend the $200 I have to my name or whatever. and just stayed there all night, went home, slept for a couple of hours, and overslept my traffic shift. And I remember driving in and trying to play it kind of cool with Kevin Eby, just being like, oh, yeah, sorry, I'm running late. And he just looked at me and goes, you were supposed to be here at 5 a.m. Like, he was so disappointed.
And how late were you?
It was like 5 p.m. Are those different
yeah.
times? No, it was probably like 7 a.m. I mean, the yeah. poor guy, he'd been there all night.
Yeah.
Like, he was the overnight shift. And there's, I mean, nothing worse than working the graveyard shift and then your relief not showing up. So you just have to keep
yeah.
staying there doing the morning traffic on KNWX or whatever. And he just looked at me like he was so – it was – The disappointment in his face has stuck with me all these years.
Yeah.
Not so much that I didn't continue to oversleep shifts, but it did make an impression on me.
It is worth noting, too, that we both overslept for a shift in Minnesota.
I overslept it more than you did, though. You were
yeah.
there when I got there.
I couldn't remember the details on that, but you and I, weren't we texting on the way there? I think I was there like minutes before you. Am I wrong about that? But it was like, it was a bad one, though. It was, we were both really hungover, and we had gone too hard the night before, but we were with Amy. Amy Wu, whom we were working for that day.
Working,
you know,
and wooking.
Wooking. We were wooking for Amy Wu. And she showed, you know, she was there
fresh
as a daisy.
Do you feel like wook culture is out of control at this point?
I do.
Is that a show title,
with
wook
culture? With the Thousand Island condiment conversation, I do think wook culture is out of control.
I'm ready.
Anyway, there was that time. I want to tell you about a time I overslept that was like probably the most dramatic oversleeping of my life. But really quickly, what happened to you at NPR with the newscast oversleeping? Because that's the thing. Like, if you're at a job for a year and then you have your first oversleeping, but you have a really good track record, it's like, well, that's really out of the ordinary for you. But if you're starting a job and you oversleep on day three, then you're kind of setting a bad reputation for yourself.
Turns out I was a non-essential component to the operation. Like, there was another producer there. They were writing news copy. It wasn't actually that big of a deal. Like, I was kind of, you know, sort of there to learn and observe and try to be helpful if I could. But it wasn't like – I wasn't Korva, you know?
Right.
It wasn't like I was the person that was supposed to go talk on the radio. So it ended up not being as huge of a deal as it felt to me. Like, I was just like, well, this is it. I'm fired. Like, they're sending me back to L.A.
Right.
I've embarrassed myself and my family. But everybody there was actually pretty chill about it, thankfully.
There was a time when I worked for my dad. In fact, my first job that lasted, you know, years was me working for my dad's company. And, you know, it might sound cushy working for your dad, but when you have a strict dad who's kind of a you know, I don't know,
yeah.
workaholic kind of guy.
And you also probably didn't want to disappoint him.
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
Especially so.
Exactly. And he wasn't laid back about, like, showing up late or whatever. Like, he really instilled in us, you know, and also just hearing him talk about, like, some of the, you know, this was a shop that had, you know, all kinds of people working for it. People who he would sometimes say would come in with the Budweiser flu and what have you, you know, welders and, you know, like people who were disappointing him all the time when they wouldn't show up or show up late with excuses and smelling like booze.
Did you have
whatnot.
A real George Michael?
Yeah.
Michael Bluth type of thing going on?
A little bit. And so, you know, and so there wasn't a lot of leeway for me. I felt like I really had to be there and on time. And this was like, you know, this was high school days. And one day, I want to put me, maybe this is my senior year of high school, maybe junior, but either way, my friend Tony came over on a, I believe, a Saturday night, and we were making movies and such, which is what we do, and we decided we were going to purposely stay up all night making movies, like stay up through dawn, which we did, and we got into, you know, whatever our nerdy adventures were. We made these movies. I remember I had this video game with, like, 92 old Atari games. It was like a Nintendo bootleg cartridge that I actually bought from Tony's dad, whatever. We were like playing Space Invaders until, like, you know, until like 5 in the morning. Then
was
we
the
breakfast.
Movie like a was it a concept like was it did it have a beginning, middle, and end and a name, or were you just filming each other being silly?
This particular movie project, I believe we were just working on the credits for a movie that was never made. But we were, because he was drawing credit screens. I was mixing music or something.
Whoa.
And then I can't remember what else. It was just like, I do remember this, because I remember we were living in Lakewood. So just to set the scene a little bit more. So this is during a period, my parents are going through a divorce at this time. So me and my dad are living together in Lakewood, Ohio, in a one-bedroom apartment. He and my mom owned this apartment building and had rented out both units for most of my life. During the divorce, you can hear Theo has heard the story before, and he's not interested in hearing it again. But he and I moved into the bottom unit, which was a one-bedroom apartment. And at this time, I was sleeping on the fold-out couch in the living room. He was sleeping in the bedroom. We ended up swapping that around later. At some point, he realized, oh, yeah, I should probably give the kid the bedroom. Anyway, where is he going to hang his Nirvana posters? But I loved it. This was actually a pretty cool time in my life. This is summertime here. Tony and I are working on our movie project. We stay up all night, and we're proud of ourselves for staying up all night or whatever. And then the afternoon comes along, and we both fall asleep. He falls asleep on the front porch, and I fall asleep on the sofa bed, which I didn't even pull out to be a bed. I just fell asleep on the sofa, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is probably, I don't know, Sunday late afternoon that we finally fall asleep after staying up all night. And then all I remember is waking up and the sun is bright in the sky. I feel completely out of my damn mind because it's more than just an oversleeping. This is an oversleeping after staying up for 24 hours. And I am beside myself. I remember rushing to the closet. This is a job where I had to wear like my Cintas uniform. So I have like my blue polyester pants. I can still smell it. They're like, I have this uniform, these scratchy polyester pants I have to put on.
Gray?
Almost plasticky. No, dark blue. And also, I think I might rewear them because they're like shop pants. So they kind of just, they smell like Cintas and steel and oil or whatever. And I throw those on. I throw on my steel-toed boots. I put on my work shirt that says Andy. I still have one of those. It's a very comfortable shirt. I guess I stole it from Cintas. And I would ride my bike into the shop. It was probably, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile tops. I had this this mountain bike that I rode everywhere. So I get on my bike and I have to ride through the metro station, the Cleveland metro station, to get to the shop. And everything just feels so weird. And I'm like, I can't believe like I did this, especially after staying up all night. And because I stayed up all night, my brain seems so fuzzy. Like the light seems weird. The sun seems weird. Everything seems really dead too. Like it just doesn't feel like a Monday morning. And I get to the shop, Luke, and it is dead. Like nobody's there. And it's all locked up. And for the only time in my life, I have to go to the store, which is like kind of across the street. I ride my bike to this little quickie mart, and I have to look at the newspaper to figure out what day it is. This is before smartphones. I literally looked at a newspaper and realized I hadn't slept all night and then slept in late. I had probably crashed out for an hour or two and woke up. It was still Sunday evening. The sun, the summer sun was still in the sky. I come home so confused and befuddled, and I find Tony sleeping on the rocker in the front, or, you know, one of those rocker benches on the front porch. He just slept through this whole thing. He had no idea that I had just woken up. I'd probably slept for an hour or two and then woke up and assumed that I had overslept. So that
you had
was
a real Scrooge moment. Oh, boy.
Yes,
is it right? What day is it, boy?
Yes, I literally had to look at a newspaper. And I also feel like I have a vague recollection of maybe asking the person at the store what day it was, like, because I just couldn't get my head around it. But I can't verify that.
Now, were you relieved or mad that you had lost even more sleep with this whole paper?
I was definitely relieved. I was definitely relieved. I mean, just not being in trouble. And again, I don't know what in trouble means. Like, I don't remember my dad, like, ever yelling at me or kicking me in the ass or, like, you know, he wasn't going to ground me for being late for work. He's just trying to teach me responsibility anyway. So I don't even know what in trouble would be, but it would have just been embarrassing and shitty. And I was so glad that, you know, if I was going to do this, I just did it to myself. And I think once I figured it out, I think it took a long time for my brain to put all the pieces together. And again, I was still, like, sleep deprived at this point. So I think I just thought it was really funny. And then I think Tony's dad took us out to eat.
I had I love that he was selling you bootleg video games.
Yeah, and he didn't give
it. Did he have them in like a trench coat? Did he open it up? He had watches.
I'm not even
bootleg
joking.
Video games.
He bought it was something 92. I still have this thing. It had 92 or 99 games on it, and it was originally Tony's. I don't remember where they got this bootleg, but it was originally Tony's, and then they found a better one. This is very Doug Corey. That's Tony's dad. He found one that had like 198 games on it. So then Tony didn't need his 92 game anymore. So they sold it to me. I remember I think I paid $200 for that thing, like in the 90s. Like I saved up. Yeah. Like I was like, I could be slightly wrong about that, but it was a big chunk of money, something that I had to, you know, save up for like all summer.
I had a very different relationship with working for my dad, which is I had zero interest in trying to impress him or be a good employee. And would only basically do it when he would sort of drag me over to the shop, I grew up basically a block, not even a block, like a house over from where my dad's sign shop was. But I would do all manner of things for him for, you know, $5 an hour or whatever, including one time he turned me loose with a grinder on his van. He said he had bought this van that was like a lot of Bondo, like there had been body work done on it. And he was like, sort of grind out these parts where the Bondo is starting to show, and then he's going to put more Bondo in there and repaint it. I thought, I really Amelia Bedelia'd it and was like, oh, I'm just supposed to grind all of the Bondo. Well, it turns out the entire side of this van was Bondo. Most of it was fine, though. You know what I mean? Like it had been professionally done. It was painted. You wouldn't know it was Bondo to look at it. And I just thought I was supposed to grind everything that was this white hard thing called Bondo. And I remember my dad coming out of his shop and just realizing that the entire side of his van had been just like destroyed. And my dad is still to this day not a like a physically violent guy. And that was the closest I think he ever came to wanting to just like go Ralph Cramden on me. He didn't, by the way, to his eternal credit. But like that was the kind of employee I was for my dad.
But I don't blame you for that, actually. Like that's the funny thing, that you think of that as one of the very, very rare times where he seemed like just legitimately angry, like he wants to send you to the moon. But the thing is, like, this was a real mistake. Of all of the shit we would do as kids, and you know, apologies for this, Luke, but especially you, for all of the like trouble that you would get, you were mischievous.
Apology not accepted.
You know, I don't know if you say mischievous or mischievous, as we discuss on the show, but like that's what you were, right? Like you were a kid who was living moss and getting into trouble and you know, trying mm-hmm. to get away with things all the time. But in this particular case, it's really nobody's fault. Like you were not trained on this, and even like scraping our house as an adult, scraping our New Hampshire house to get it prepped for
it's hard
painting,
to know when to
you
stop.
You don't know
right?
when to stop, and I had no
What's
experience
the edge of
with
this?
It before, right? And like, and then when we were using eventually some sort of electric sander as well, and then you're like, well, do I take it all down? Like once you start getting one part smooth, it's really, really hard to know like what is acceptable and how far to go down everywhere on the, you know, when you're talking about scraping the paint. So anyway, I can imagine like I've never had to deal with Bondo before. I wouldn't know. You can't just give somebody that. I'm not trying to blame the victim again, but like you can't just give somebody that and expect them to know.
You know what? We got to take a break. I've got to call Walt because I got to.
Let's call him on the show. Don't waste that.
I've got to settle a score with him because I've carried this around my whole life, and you're absolutely right. That was not very clear advice from old Walt B.
Like, if you've never seen anybody do it before, like, that's the type of thing where I feel like if, you know, like, let's say this was a task given to me at Walsh Manufacturing Incorporated. Yeah, they're incorporated. Are they? Mm-hmm. I think so. Boy, Theo is driving me crazy. I'll take care of that during the break, too. Don't worry. I'm not going to kill him. I'm just going to put him somewhere. But
you have a talk with Theo. I'll have a talk with my dad.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the type of thing where you need to, like, kind of see somebody do it for a while, be trained on it, have somebody sit there and watch you do it so that you can get a sense of when it's done. So,
right.
No, that's on you.
I'm no Earl Scheib.
You needed to be an apprentice.
Did you guys have Earl Scheib out there?
I don't know.
The Cleveland area. That was the, like, that and Mako.
Mako was a big one. I remember that.
Were the go-tos for auto repair. I would see these Earl Scheib ads that would be like, you could get your whole car painted for $99. And even as a kid, I thought, that's not enough for that job.
Yeah.
Something's got to be off about that.
Yeah. What is off about anyway. That? Is it a loss leader?
Okay, let's take a quick break. I'll deal with my family issues, you deal with your family issues, and then we'll be back with more TBTL in just a moment.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
Tim Berners-Lee, I should say Sir Tim Berners-Lee, is selling the first browser code for the internet as an NFT. The code up for auction contains elements of the web that many of us are familiar with today. This is an article, Mitchell Clark writing in The Verge, including functions to parse and display HTML documents, rudimentary styling support, the HTTP protocol, and printing of a web page. The thing about this, Andrew, is if you buy this, you actually probably won't be able to find anywhere to run it.
Hmm.
Ars Technica says that basically they don't have, like, there aren't any websites that can actually, or there are very few websites that can operate this code that Tim Berners-Lee actually wrote that became essentially the internet.
I'm sorry to take the conversation here because I just don't think it's fair to ask each other questions about this stuff that we clearly don't understand. But I feel like you understand it better than I, at least. But I thought the whole point of an NFT was its value is you're inherently attaching a value to something and kind of monetizing it. And it can just be, you know, whether it's a piece of art or a baseball card or a basketball card or what have you. In this case, I'm getting confused because it sounds like the value here is that you actually own this code. I guess code can be copied, but now you can have the NFT version, the official version of this code. I'm getting confused as to what is like symbolic uniqueness that gives something its value and something that is just inherently valuable because of what it is.
Right. Well, he never – part of one of these articles I read about this point out that Tim Berners-Lee never like patented – or copywrote or trademarked any of this stuff. So I don't know if that's part of it. By the way, there is a history professor who focuses on web archives named Ian Milligan who says, this seems to be a way to create scarcity of items that wouldn't otherwise be scarce, like digital art. It seems almost like it's not just the source code, but it really is this comprehensive package that a collector could really cherish having. Also, by the way, this comes with like a 30-second silent video wherein he's like typing the code out or something and like a poster you can print out that has his signature on it and also shows some like this code kind of spread out in a larger way.
It's like a box set.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I guess that Kings of Leon thing went pretty well because it's also mentioned in some of these articles. Remember we talked about that, I think, back when they announced that they were releasing, like, they were the first band to release their album as an NFT, and it came with all these, like, a free front row seat to, like, all of their concerts and a limo ride or whatever. I guess that made millions of dollars.
Jeez.
Also, this guy Kevin Roos, who writes for the New York Times, and by the way, I think he's really
great.
Good.
Yeah.
Love his stuff. He created an NFT. All the money went to charity, for the record, but he basically wrote an article that was an NFT and it sold for like almost $900,000.
I just don't understand it, bro. in the words of Kanye West, like, isn't there a bubble? Like, what is making these things valuable? I mean, I guess that's where you get into the kind of this is involved with the bit mining and whatever, too, right?
Like, floppy disks?
It's just...
Power gloves?
I mean, you can tell I don't have the energy... Like, I don't have the energy to understand it. It just... I don't understand how this isn't a bubble at this point.
I kind of thought it had burst a little bit. I read, like, one article that said, like, oh, the NFT boom is ending because everyone realized that it's kind of not real. And I was so gratified by that because as someone who's missed out on every element of the crypto and NFT bubble, I just want it to crash because then I'll feel less bad. In fact, you know, I've mentioned this on the show before that when I was a kid and I was riding in the back of a car, my friend Colin's dad said, I wish that the stock market would just crash and go to zero. And I never knew what he meant by that.
Yeah.
I may finally understand what he meant by that. He probably didn't have any stock, and he just felt bad about not being in on it. I kind of went all – I mean, peace and love to our listeners that are, like, heavily leveraged into crypto and NFT. But, like, I kind of want it to all crash so that I can get back in on the ground floor because I've really missed the ground floor.
The ground floor of this or the ground floor of whatever's around the corner.
all of it, whatever. Yeah. I don't know.
I wanted to crash just so I can stop. Like, and no, this is going to sound, Luke, I swear, this is not a meta statement on the show or the fact that this is a topic, but like, part of me is just like, generally speaking, you can hear the exhaustion in my voice. Like, how many times is there just going to be another story, whether we talk about it here on TBTL or it just like, you know, in our social gatherings about like NFT, which, oh, did you hear about this latest NFT? And oh, yeah, mm-hmm. which always raises more questions than answers. And then I just get exhausted. And like, I want it to just fail so that I can stop trying to understand it and talk about it. Like, it's just seemed because it does. And it seems both, you know, incomprehensible to me in a lot of ways. By the way, this is not an invitation for anybody to explain it to me. I'll delete the email so fast your head will spin. But it's also just like, it's complicated, but also it's just the same story over and over and over again. And it also just seems stupid, which is just like, I know, just like a real dumb take on this, but I think I'm just exhausted with NFT shit.
What was the thing that just became an NFT the other day and like everybody tweeted it at us?
Was it a Garfield phone? No.
No, it wasn't. No, there was something else that people were emailing us and tweeting it at us. That was, I forget. It was something that was very TBTL.
Wow. I'll be honest. I can't think of it. Maybe I'll buy you some time if you want to scroll through your mentions. But
you know, the only thing that I would buy as an NFT would be the guy on QVC hurting himself with the samurai sword.
What would it be? The sword or the video? Just the NFT
video
version of the
video.
I
want Odell to digitally sign it. I'm so obsessed with that lately. I don't know where that's coming from. But that would be a thing that I would want to buy. But yeah, I don't. Oh, also the Charlie bit my finger video.
Oh,
that went for,
right. Yes.
That got NFT'd. That's not the thing, by the way.
Yeah, that's
something
not,
else.
Something that we didn't talk about. I was thinking, so the other day, and I don't know why, but somebody posted something about a Wu-Tang song that I'd never heard of. Now, keep in mind, there are way more Wu-Tang songs that I've never heard of than I've heard of. You know, there's all different kind of incarnations of that group. But anyway, I found myself, I think, on Saturday
morning.
Would
you say they morning, rock the world, Andrew?
Wu-Tang, baby! They rock the world!
This is exactly where I was going to take it, although you've promised me that you deleted that. Like, that was our NFT, that you promised me that you deleted that forever. I remember being in L.A., and I said, I want you to delete that forever, and you made a big show of it, and then it keeps popping up like a herpy, Luke. I think that you lied to me. But I was, that's where I was going to bring it back to, actually, because I kind of went on some sort of weird, you know, you're laying in bed and you're scrolling on your phone kind of rabbit hole-y thing about, like, wait, where does this Wu-Tang song fit into the grand scheme of things? And I start going backwards, and I'm like, oh yeah, that this was the album that was after the record that they made one copy of, just one copy, and they sold it to that asshole Martin Shkreli, right?
Yeah, but they were way ahead of the curve.
That's what I'm getting at, like, in a certain way. And that's actually what that drop of Cher singing Wu-Tang Baby They Rock the World, that was from, that's one of the only parts of that record that we, the public can hear, because the rest is on a one single, I believe it's a CD, right? Isn't that how that was distributed to Shkreli?
I feel like a CD, it's so sad, like it should be on vinyl or
something.
Oh, no,
right? Maybe it must be vinyl, yeah. It's probably vinyl.
Really, the Wu-Tang, like, they should come perform it live for you.
Yeah.
In your house, right?
And we
just
did
like
it.
That's the, if you pay $1 million or $2 million. The Charlie Bit My Finger thing, they're leaving it up on YouTube, though.
Yes, just see, that's the thing. The value isn't just being able to see it, because there's a right. million copies of that. It's that, hey, you own the, and it's not even right.
I think
right?
the value is bragging to your friends when you're mildly drunk.
I guess so, but then also cashing in.
Yes, some of these things, like there's that piece of art that sold for $69 million by this artist. It was called Every Day, the First 5,000 Days. It's called Beeple. And it was this piece of digital art that sold for $69.3 million, which I assume the people who bought that were buying it because they thought it would have more value later, like buying a Picasso or something.
Mm-hmm, because it's art, yeah.
Right. So some of it is, you know, people buying it because they think there's value to it. But, like, I mean, the Charlie Bit My Finger thing, I wonder if the people who bought that for $700,000 are buying it because they think it's a investment, or just because they want to brag to their friends. And by the way, how much are they trying to bring that up in conversation now?
Right. Well, yeah, do you think I'm sick of talking about it? Think about their friends.
Like, oh, don't get your finger caught in that. That would really hurt. Charlie, that would hurt. Hey, have I mentioned I own the NFT of Charlie That Hurt?
So in other words, in this scenario, in this role playing, they keep on bringing up the finger thing because they want to talk about it. Okay, gotcha. It's not
right,
their friends trying to bring it up.
Everyone's like, we're pretty over that. And also, that was, why did you spend $700,000 on it? There's a lot of things you could have spent that money on.
Yeah, including... what has Tubin volunteering for? You could have spent that money at his food bank.
Oh, you know what it was, Andrew? Thank you. We got there. Anthony Weiner. And we did mention it kind of in passing on the show.
Right.
He was floating the idea to Ben Smith in the New York Times of making an NFT out of his tweet that basically began the unraveling of his life and career.
Right, right. I think you must have been I do remember mentioning that on the show. I think people must have sent that to you a lot more than they sent it to me.
That's kind of my lane, Andrew.
Yeah, exactly.
People know me for inappropriate tweets and non-fungible tokens. I can't remember if I said this to you on the show or off the show, but one of the greatest tweets ever from our friend Ken Jennings is, could God make a token so non-fungible that even he couldn't funge it.
That's so good. That's really
good.
Which
is so genius.
Yeah.
Shout out to listener Lisa, who sent this article along. Crayfish. Do you go with crayfish or crawdads?
Can I go with crawfish? I feel like, and I feel like we called them crawfish growing up, although I never actually like had a river or a creek where I had crawfish, but I would hear about them a lot.
I was obsessed with trying to catch crawdads. To what end, I don't know, but I would go down to Green Lake and I would bring I would tie a piece of chicken on a rope and lower it down into these areas of the lake where I was told by older kids that there were crawdads. And that allegedly the crawdad or crayfish or crawfish would just grab onto the chicken and just stay holding onto it as you pulled them out of the water.
Still, though, well, but I mean, did you have that experience or supposedly
no.
That's what was going to happen?
No, it was there may not even have been crawdads in that lake, okay. But I was told by older kids that this was a thing and it became an obsession of mine.
Okay, so you never put eyes on one either? Because growing up in the country, like, there are all kinds of, like, you know, there were kids who had creeks and streams in their backyards, and like that was always my ideal. Like, whether like you make a little boat and you float it down, or you're always out there catching crawfish. I don't even know if they had crawfish in my part of the country. It doesn't seem like it, but like I never if there were crawfish in Valley City, Ohio, I ain't never seen one.
Huh. That seems like Valley City, Ohio seems like it would be, isn't it the frog jumping capital?
Oh, most certainly, yes.
Well, the frog jumping capital's got to have some crawdads in it.
You would think. I don't know. Where do crawdads live? Everywhere?
Lakes, streams, and that's part of this article. They basically have figured out that crawdads exposed to antidepressants via contaminated water behave more boldly, emerging from hiding more quickly and spending longer looking for food, according to a study. This was published in the journal Ecosphere, and it's basically the study's about the unintended impact that human medicines have on aquatic environments.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically, we are all on some sort of medication, and we're all either urinating it out, mictrating it out to the rivers and seas, or we're literally flushing pills down the toilet, which I guess they advise against, which is kind of interesting because they're also telling you to not keep old medicine around because that can be addictive and a problem for some people. Mm-hmm. But you're also not supposed to flush it down the toilet because it'll make the crawdads too bold.
Oh, yeah. By the way, definitely there are definitely crayfish in Ohio. The rusty crayfish is Ohio's most common and widespread species.
Also a great bar in Key West.
The rusty crayfish. Oh, my God, Luke.
I had some times there.
Luke, I want to be drinking with you at the rail at the Rusty Crayfish so bad right now. It's got that rope. It's got that rough rope maybe along the bar. You know what I'm talking about? Oh, I can feel
with
it.
Some sea glass in it. Those like fishing kind of floats and bob. Like there's a net with that kind of like, you know, what would you call that? Basically,
the
old
net
glass
stuff.
That would keep the net floating or whatever. Is that what that was for?
And then also, I'm going to get a big basket of just fried whatever. Mm-hmm. Just, God damn.
You know, the server's hand might be part of it. They fried their hand and they handed you the whole thing. I'm looking up if the Rusty Crawfish is a bar, Andrew. And
wherever it is, that's where we're going.
Huh.
Today.
There does not appear to be... I see this as a business opportunity.
Let's make an NFT bar. Wait, what?
I could see us, you know, when everybody leaves us and when this has all come to its natural end, you and I just going straight up Morgan Freeman and Andy Dufresne, except yes. R.Z. Wantanejo is Key West, and we open the Rusty Crawfish.
How is there not? I was so dubious of your Google search that I had to check it out too. How has no?
You know what? This business relationship is falling apart. You don't trust me.
Oh my God! Also, I think one of us has to go by the name Rusty, right?
You have redder hair than me, so I think it's on you.
I'll be Rusty. That's fine.
Do you know it's a minor miracle that I don't have red hair?
No.
My biological father had it, and my biological half-brother looks like Andy Dalton. I mean, is a dead ringer for the quarterback Andy Dalton. That's how red his hair is. And I guess my paternal granddad, his nickname was Red.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm the first person in the lineage who doesn't have, like, extremely noticeable red hair.
Anyway,
this was the other thing about this. Also, I did a Google search for the Rusty Crawdad.
Yeah, anything there?
Nope.
Wow.
Again, this is a real business opportunity.
Absolutely. I'm going to probably have to be the guy who does the dishes, right? But we're going to have one of those big metal sinks that has
Ask yourself if you're running our fantasy baseball team right now. And then you'll know the answer.
I'm excited about it because it's going to be one of those
What your level of work's going to be at the Rusty Crawfish.
It's going to be one of those big sinks with the faucet that goes way high in the air and it's got a spring around it. And I pull it down and I press the button. It just shoots that. Yeah, this is good. I'm really excited to do this.
I guess they do try to filter out. I guess they have a system. Water departments do for filtering out some things that get into the water supply, get into the rivers and the lakes.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess they don't currently typically try to screen out SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors. But I feel like let the fish have a good time.
Yeah, how are the fish doing? Have we
like,
tried talk
leave
therapy
the
with
antidepressants.
Them as well?
Don't filter that out. Leave that in the water. These fish have and crawdads have so little fun in their life. I feel like let's give them the antidepressants.
I feel like there's a more logical reason why we can't do that, but I don't want to ruin the fun either.
No, the problem is that these crawdads in this study were so bold that they were then exposing themselves to danger.
They're just exposing themselves. They're going
also
to the
become extremely randy.
Oh, and inappropriate.
No, they did a study and they exposed some of them to the antidepressants, and then some of them they didn't give the antidepressants to. And the ones they gave the antidepressants to, they basically got really active. They went out looking for food, and that would mean that they would likely get eaten by more eels, turtles, mammals, and birds.
Mm.
So if we were to actually give them the antidepressants, they would not exist for very long as a species because they would be out partying it up right before they all got eaten.
And my guess is, maybe this article got into it, Luke, I don't know. My guess is then if a predator then eats one of these things, then that, let's call it poison, is in that predator's system too. The
happy poison.
Or whatever. Yeah, the happy poison.
Also, there would be a problem, according to this article, because crawdads or crayfish eat algae and other organic matter that impacts the recycling of nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
So if you mess with any part of the food chain or the circle of life, you can get into some trouble there.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Anyway, I guess we probably should not give the crawdads antidepressants. Do you want to talk about this dream story real fast? It's been on the list for weeks.
Oh, yeah. Now, I have to reach back in my memory for some of the dazzling details of this story. But, yes, and do you even remember the publication? I'm scrolling back in time here. I'll figure out the publication later. But it was kind of a roundup of ways researchers are working on and in the past have worked on affecting people's dreams, which is obviously something that is very kind of close to my heart. Like we were talking, Luke, earlier about those kind of dreams we have when we're kind of in a half awake, half sleep state. We've already woken up. We've gone to the bathroom. We have one more hour to sleep. And you might dream in these moments something specific around about your surroundings. Like I'll never forget the time Genevieve woke up and she had just had a dream that she was in a bright room and she was trying to close all the blinds and she couldn't get all the blinds closed. And then she woke up and realized that the light was just blasting through our window directly on her face. Or, of course, people will know the feeling of you have to pee in a dream and hopefully you wake up in time and then you have to pee in real life and you go use the restroom. So obviously these external, you know, things in the real world affect what we're dreaming about. So doesn't that mean that there would be opportunities to affect that even more on purpose? And one thing that people are messing around with is virtual reality. And I can't remember the details on this, but there's some sort of test or study where they were...
I think they had people pretend to be a bird.
Exactly, where people were flying around for, I don't know, let's say an hour or so using virtual reality, which is a game that you and I have played, by the way. What, aren't you a dove in France or something? Kamara Kev has
a
that
game? A pigeon, maybe?
Yeah, sure.
Kamara Kev has that. And by the way, peace and love to our friends who have done that. But I'm specifically thinking of our friend Rodin doing it. But... I don't think a human being can look more ridiculous.
Oh, on the outside.
Than wearing
a
VR helmet and glasses and pretending to be a bird.
Yeah.
It's deeply fun if you're doing it, and it's deeply embarrassing for the person doing it if you're watching them.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. I've only done that once. It was at Kamara Kev's. I know you guys have all clocked a little bit more hours with that. I got into surprisingly, I thought I'd want to just play the open world bird game, but I got into some scary game where I was in like a cart. Like it was a horror show or something, and like clowns were jumping. It was like a haunted house kind of thing, but I was in like a mine cart. You know those rides where you're kind of in a cart and you go through a haunted house?
Sure.
It was like that, only as terrifying. I don't know.
This was a thing you did at Camaro's?
Yeah, maybe he didn't let you play. I don't think you were there this evening.
He knows my brain's not ready for that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it was weird because I'm not into stuff like that. But anyway, so they would, you know, put these goggles on people. They didn't mess around with the scary clown shit, but they just said, you know, put these on, fly around like a bird for a while, then we're going to put you to sleep or go to sleep. And people were much more likely to have dreams that they were flying in some way or another, or a bird in some way or another. And like that totally makes sense to me, man. In those phases I get into where I'm playing a lot of Minecraft, which even though it's a really, you know, blocky looking game, it's actually pretty immersive and you can just like lose time in there. When I get into those modes where I'm playing that game a lot, I will so easily dream of, sometimes it'll be a Minecrafty world. Other times it'll be like an IRL world, but I'm digging in the dirt, constantly digging. So like there are things. One thing that I thought was fascinating was there was a study, I believe, from the 1970s where they exposed sleeping volunteers to the smell of rotten eggs and some other volunteers to the smell of roses or something nice. And it seemed to be a correlation between bad dreams and good dreams based on what you were smelling. Of course, the bad smells leading to bad dreams.
This is the way that they did this study. A hand-worn sleep tracker monitored the subject's heart rate, electrical changes on the skin surface, and the amount their fingers were bent or relaxed to detect when a sleeper entered something called hypnagogia and was therefore open to the influence from outside audio cues. Then they would deliver audio at this moment, and then it would actually make its way into people's dreams. This seems like the kind of thing with our fitness watches and all this stuff, that all this kind of wearable tech. This seems like the kind of thing that is not far off for like the consumer, right? Like,
yeah.
I bet you anything that at some point our watches will be able to detect when we're sleeping. They probably already can, and then could tell our phone to start playing something or, you know, do what they were doing in the study to kind of prompt us in a direction, which I don't know. It seems both cool and kind of uncanny.
I would go for this. If there was some, and I'll bet you we will see it in our lifetime, like if there was something that I can plug into my phone and then maybe I wear headphones or whatever the stimuli are, but somebody said basically technology that lets you dial up a dream, like, or at least an attempt at dreaming in a certain scenario. Like, I find that fascinating. I'm trying to think where I'd want to go.
Doesn't that feel so Blade Runner, though?
This doesn't seem that
like,
Blade Runner
to me. Let's all get into
me.
Our sleep pod and let's decide what kind of dream we want to have tonight. I mean, it sounds fun, but it also seems like the thing that would be in a science fiction movie about the future that indicates that somehow we've become less than human.
It seems a little bit sci-fi to me, but not in a bad way at all, and not in a way that seems less than human. Like, this to me, because it's so right there on the surface, it seems so obvious to me. And again, I know I have a slight obsession with this, and I love talking about dreams, but, like, it's so obvious that I feel like we can almost do it already just by, like, putting ourselves in a certain mind frame or, like, playing a video game over and over. You know that that's going to affect your dreams. Why not just have a little bit more control over that? I mean, we're not talking about – I'm not saying, hey, I'm going to volunteer for somebody to put literally some sort of biochip in my body that would affect my dreams. That would be different. But what I feel like this article really underscores is that, like, the line between the sleeping world and the awake world is pretty thin. So why not manipulate that a little bit in some safe ways?
What would you want to dream about?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. I got to say, the other day I had a dream that was very rooted in my childhood home. And I've had those, you know, throughout the years. And I think I even mentioned to you on the show, I went to all these, like, websites to try to figure out what this symbolizes. I don't know. It always symbolizes the same thing. I don't know. Change and open to new experiences or whatever it says inside your fortune cookie. Like, honestly, like, those dream dictionaries are just always – I feel like it's always the same vague answer. But there was something nice about being in this dream where I was exploring my old childhood home. That was kind of cool. But also, I wonder if there are other worlds that maybe, like, what about an undersea adventure? Like, I don't think I've ever had an undersea adventure in my dream.
I would dream about dating Jennifer Coolidge.
You literally did do that.
Oh, yeah. I'm ahead of science on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I would want to dream about, I don't know, though, because we had a voicemail from an actual therapist on this subject, like, yesterday.
Yeah.
But I also feel like if I were to dream about, like, somebody I love who's passed away being alive, I could see the upside of that in that it would feel good to interact with that person.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think I would still be bummed when I woke up or if I dreamed that I won the lottery or whatever. I just feel like it would be – I would feel sad when I woke up because this thing that was making me happy that I thought was reality is not reality.
That's interesting. Well, what if it was a more vague thing? What if it was just if you could just say, hey, I'm going to have a flying dream tonight. Would that seem appealing to you?
Yes, it seems like it would be fun. And I've actually had dreams where I can fly. When I fly in my dreams, it's like I'm swimming in the air. And I have to sort of like, basically the harder that I do the swim motion, that's like the faster I go or the higher I go up.
That sounds
and
cool.
It's fun, but then I wake up and I'm bummed that I can't fly.
You're bummed you can't fly. It doesn't just feel like, wow, what an adventure. I'm trying to think if I mean, do you always feel bummed when you wake up from a dream that is not a bad dream?
Not always. Like, if it's a bad dream. Oh, you're saying,
yeah,
it's
like
not a bad dream.
Not a bad dream.
No,
yeah.
I mean, usually I'm just like, why was I dating Jennifer Coolidge? Like, I'm usually confused.
Right.
But I'm not there. What I do now, if I'm like having a dream that I have won the lottery or won a bunch of money, which is a fairly recurring dream for me, I'll try to wake myself up in the dream because I'll be like, this is a dream. I know what's happening. And I'm unsuccessful at waking myself up. But I will say that when I wake up, I'm always like, ah, man, back to my normal life, back to the old salt mine of doing this podcast with my friend Andrew.
Which sounds awful. I don't know, man. There's something – if I would do anything to remember my – I guess I wouldn't do anything because I'm sure there's all kinds of like dietary and habit-forming things that I could do or habit changes I could make
in
order
to remember my dreams. So you mean you wouldn't do anything?
So what I wouldn't do is anything to change my lifestyle that affect my dreams. No, but there is something that I really enjoy about just the richness of my dreamscapes when they are rich and when I remember them. And sometimes – I'm not saying I never wake up with a feeling of longing to be back in that world, but usually it's just more of a fascination that like, wow, what a what a complicated world I just woke up from, but it's also interesting to see why I had those dreams. Like I mentioned on yesterday's show, and I believe several times now on the podcast, that like after the TBTelethon, I just had so many very specific dreams that are so clearly related to our adventures on the road, whether it was a stress dream of me trying to set up equipment and I'd forgotten all the equipment, or trying to get a show posted in a moving van and then a fire hose hit me for some reason. I don't know where the fire hose came from in the dream. But like remembering all of the details surrounding this, I'm always dreaming that I'm in a hotel room somewhere and about to go somewhere formal. That's a very common thing. I don't have to list all of my dreamscapes, but like for me, whatever joy I get from that, and I can't fully explain why I get joy from it, but it's waking up and having that moment where you think, oh wait, I was dreaming about something. I can't remember what it was. And then you take a moment, and sometimes you just remember one tiny detail of the dream.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, elevator button. And then you can suddenly picture that elevator button, and then sometimes that will
Jennifer Coolidge got into the elevator.
That'll be a key that unlocks everything else. You're like, oh, that's right, I was going to a wedding. Oh, that's right, and my old friend Jenny was there, or whatever. And then sometimes you just like remember one thing, you pull that thread, and it all comes. Other times it's completely infuriating. Like I had a dream the other day in my kind of half sleep thing when I was waking up, and I know I was in somebody's hotel room. I can't remember who it was, and I was on the floor, and I found a penny on the floor, and I was kind of, and I remember thinking like, "Ooh, I should grab that penny," but also it's kind of gross to find a penny on a hotel floor. I was like looking under the bed or something like that.
I've done grosser things.
Oh yeah, and
stirring a drink with the remote control.
That's all I remember about that dream.
Was that real?
I think that might have been real, but like I kept coming back to that thing, that moment where I found the penny, and I kept thinking like, come on man, this is the key, remember the rest of it, and I could not remember the rest of the dream. And it's so funny that I've been thinking about that for days now, that I can't unlock whatever else I was dreaming about in that moment.
Well, that's the other thing that they'll probably figure out technologically pretty soon, is some kind of dream diary, right? I mean, I guess you would have to wake up enough to recite whatever it was that was going on in your brain, like into your watch or into your phone. So I don't know, maybe that's not something that they can accomplish. But it seems like they should be able to figure out a way, if you have a dream, to kind of gently wake you up, and then maybe you, I don't know, record what it is that you ever. I'll tell you this, every thought that I have as I'm falling asleep seems profound to me, and it's always just total shite.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like I'm when I'm falling asleep, I have a thought and I'm like, okay, that is a great joke. I need to put that on Twitter, or that is a great idea for a movie, or that is a great whatever. Like my grandiosity as I fall asleep is insane. And then I wake up and I think back to what it was I was so hyped about, and I'm like, oh, that was a terrible idea.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the fact that you can remember it though is, you know, that's a positive right there. All right, I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to TBTL.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I got to say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to TBTL.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
Here I go once again with the email. Every week I hope that it's from a female. Oh man, it's not from a female.
All right, emails or V-mails before we get out of here?
Yeah, I worry that these are going to upset you a little bit, or at least this one is. We got a message from Danny who wants you to know that Marilyn Vos Savant is still in Parade magazine, Luke.
I love it.
Oh, you love it. I thought that you were anti.
I mean, I didn't understand it as a. I still thought it was kind of weird that you would ask this very smart person a question that she would have more or less an unlimited amount of time to respond to.
Uh-huh, right.
But I love that it still exists. Now, tell me, Howard Hughes is still in there, which was a cartoon about a dog. About a sheepdog. And you've got all of the high points of Parade magazine.
You
got
to get yourself on the Parade magazine parade again. But anyway, it says here that they've cut her column back substantially. And then Danny sent in three PDFs of recent columns. The first one here, and I honestly have not even looked at these.
This could be a summer game.
Fun. Do you want me to? What would be the game?
We just basically answer the same question that Marilyn Vos Savant has answered. And
do you want me to
see
say
how we do?
That's actually a really good thing to remind people. You and I are going to start recording the summer games shows that will be appearing later in July, but we're going to start that this week and next week. So please, if you have any suggestions for us, a fun quiz to find out our personality based on the foods we eat or what have you, send it my way, andrew@tbtl.net, or if you want to make a quiz to try to challenge us, but we are going to start that process in the next few days, so please send them to me. I'm going to blow this game, though, right here.
Yes.
The first Ask Marilyn is, during the pandemic, I've learned to appreciate my house cleaner, says Mandy Gordon of Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm shocked at how much dust accumulates and how often I need to take out the trash. Where does all of this come from? Wait a second. The question is, where does dust and garbage come from?
What?
Sorry, I'm dumbfounded at how stupid this email is, or this letter.
Well, let
to
me see. So,
Marilyn.
What was Marilyn Vos Savant's? If I were to answer this question, I would say, "Well, there's a lot of particulates in the air."
Yeah,
and so when you're home more, you probably notice it more, and also you're probably stirring up more dander and particulates just through physical activity in the home. And so it would seem like there's more dust than there used to be, but it's just you're observing it more and you're in a way creating more of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you essentially answered it. This email, I'm not even going after Marilyn here. This email from Mandy Gordon, who I really hope is not a TBTL listener, but just like it starts with, I've learned to appreciate my house cleaner. You're already starting from a point of kind of like, I haven't been dealing with this shit myself for a while. Again, not that there's anything wrong with having a house cleaner. It just sort of seemed like a tone deaf way to start this thing. And then you just ask about I'm shocked at how much dust accumulates, but also and how much I need to take out the trash. Where does this all come from? Well, Marilyn does a good job of just ignoring the trash question. The trash comes from every time you throw something in the trash can, Mandy.
Is that what she writes?
Well, no. Here's what Marilyn says.
What's she say?
House dust comes from dander, bits of skin cells, hair, carpet, and rug fluff, clothing and paper fibers, fragments of dead insects, heating and cooling systems, and much more. The accumulation has been greater during the pandemic because we've been spending much more time at home. In general, the more activity, the more dust. Before that,
did I not just say this?
You did.
I am the world's
I'm
second
saying,
smartest person.
I agree. Before that, after Mandy Gordon of Salt Lake City, Utah. Before that, we were shedding at the office and shops and outdoors, plus cooking at home fills waste baskets with cans, boxes, and food waste. So she did address the where does garbage come from. It comes from you, Mandy. It comes from the stuff that you're throwing in the garbage. Like, come on. All right. I'm going to calm down for a second. This next one is going to calm me down. This comes from Doug Bloom of North Branch, Minnesota. Hey, Minnesota. Most stars are millions or even billions of light years away, so might many of the stars we see in the night sky no longer exist? I think you already know the answer to that, Doug. It sounds like more of a comment than a question. Doug says, Marilyn says, first, the stars we can see with the unaided eye are much closer, less than about 1,000 light years away. Still, because stars are so extremely long-lived, it's almost certain that the vast majority of them, including the distant ones that require a telescope to view, are still twinkling away. But it's quite true that even if the brightest stars in the sky, Sirius, which is relatively close at 8.6 light years away, were to disappear tomorrow, we wouldn't know about it for nearly a decade. So
a decade?
It takes a decade.
Huh. The sun takes like 8 minutes, right? The light from the sun takes 8 minutes to travel to us?
Don't know. Can't answer that. Sorry.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. Do you know how much it costs to open and close the, I almost said Safeco Field, but T-Mobile Park roof?
I am going. Do you know this number?
I have a rough number. I looked it up the other day because I had heard. Well, I'm not going to say any more. I'll tell you why I looked it up. But
I am guessing. I don't know where I'm getting this number from. That it costs $1,000.
I see. That's the thing. I thought in the back of my head, I heard some rumor that it costs a lot of money to open and close the roof. And our friend Anna, who you might know as J-Dog's partner, Luke. J-Dog and Anna were at the game the other night. We were texting. And I saw that Anna tweeted at the Mariners and said, please open this roof. Daylight is a finite resource or something. And in the back of my head, I thought, well, Anna, you know, it costs like a grand to open and close that thing. And then I thought, no, that can't be right. That just can't be right. And I
looked it
up.
Would the $1,000 be like?
Yeah, like
electricity for the wheels, electricity.
And it turns out, no. I don't know why you and I both thought that, if that's a rumor that goes around. But according to various, you know, message boards and stuff that I was on, a lot of people said that they had read somewhere that it's like $14 for a full open and close, or like
less than a beer.
Yes, yes. At Safeco, yeah, or at T-Mobile. But, yeah, so it was like $7 to open that. So, like, hey, Mariners, I'll pay the $7. Open the roof for Anna.
They can't do it, though, because of the pandemic, Andrew.
Anyway.
I'm sorry. Fair housing law says we are not allowed to open the roof.
All right. So there you go.
Okay, one more. Wait. Okay. Any more Maryland Vos Savant?
I just thought I ruined those enough that we were getting out. But, okay, here's the final one. Okay.
Enjoying showing off to the listeners the big brain on burbs.
Is it possible to not see something right in front of you? All right. Amy Weinstock of Ames, Iowa, you're coming in strong. I already like this. Is it possible to not see something right in front of you? Sometimes my husband scares me while driving. I'll see an unexpected object well ahead of time, such as an animal crossing the road or a barricade, and I'll warn him, but he seems not to see it until the last second when he's hit the brakes. Do you want to take a stab at this, Luke?
So the question is it possible to have, you know, essentially functional vision, but to look at something, but to not actually see it?
I guess. So is it possible to not see something right in front of
you? I don't
think
it's possible to not see it, but I think it's possible to not register it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're probably seeing it, but your brain is elsewhere. And it's just like rods and cones and pixels and power gloves.
Mm-hmm.
But my guess would be if you have functional vision, you can't not see something, but you can not let it into your brain that you're seeing it.
Before I hand this off to Marilyn, let me address it and also respond to you, Luke, because I feel like there are two different things here, because I agree with you. Like, I thought that Amy Weinstock of Ames, Iowa, was going to say, sometimes my husband is staring in the cupboard asking, where are the beans? And the beans are right in front of him. Like, that's something that, like, I think I do a lot. I'll go through the cupboard. I'll be like, Genevieve, I cannot find the fancy toothpicks that turn into umbrellas. We use those a lot. And like, Genevieve, and she'll say, they're right in front of you. And I know they are. And then she'll get up from the couch and then she'll just like point to them and they're like right in front of me. So that's definitely like me. That's not a problem with my eyesight. That is something about me focusing in the wrong place. However, when you and I were on this road trip, and this is the same when I'm on a road trip with Genevieve or driving with Vives, like if we're looking for, I don't know, a gas station sign or a hotel sign, you guys will always see it well before me. And I think that has to do with my eyesight, because we'll be looking for it. You know, it's not like distracted by something else.
Right. Well, that's just a question of eyesight then.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's certainly possible for people based on their vision to not see things.
Right.
But if the idea is that this woman's husband has vision that works, or his glasses correct his vision, and he's looking at something that he's about to run right over or through, and until she yells at him, hey, there's a moose in the road.
Right.
I don't think it's he can't see the moose. I think it's that he is daydreaming, probably about Marilyn Vos Savant.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or
what does Marilyn say about this?
Marilyn says, Amy, it's rare that we receive such stupid questions, especially from the great state of Iowa. No, she says, yes, this may occur when your attention is so focused on one aspect of your visual field that you fail to perceive other elements. In the case of driving, you may become hypnotized by the monotony of the road until you're jolted back into awareness. Some people even experience amnesia and arrive at their destination without remembering the drive. When you're on long drives, especially if it's a long drive you do over and over, like Genevieve used to have to drive 60 miles one way to get to her job in New Hampshire, like I think that's where you can really start to just like lose time.
Yeah, and that feeling of like, you know that you drove somewhere because you are there, but you have no memory of stopping at any lights, mm-hmm. of obeying any traffic laws, mm-hmm. and you're thinking, was I just going straight up like Mr. Magoo sleepwalking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was I just like water skiing on a bunch of alligators at some point, and I just didn't even know it was happening?
Did Mr. Magoo do that?
Yeah, the bit. And I, you know, I wonder, it's probably, I bet that we wouldn't laugh at that cartoon now because it's, the joke is about him being visually impaired.
Oh, he's not the drunk. Oh, right. I'm confusing.
But he was, he had bad eyesight,
right.
And he would always be getting into situations because he didn't know what was going on because he couldn't see things.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I was, you know, I was confused. You do this too. I was confusing him with Andy Capp, who is an alcoholic.
Yes. Is always down the bar, right? Is that right. A British? Is that a British comic? It feels very British to me.
Because of his Jeff cap and scarf?
Because of his hat? Because I feel like they call it the pub?
Yeah, it could be.
All right, I think I did pretty well on that, by the way.
Yeah, no, I think you did really well, too.
If Maryland ever needs to take a week off, I want Parade Magazine to know I'm offering my services. I'm also offering my services of drawing Howard huge. If they need that.
Oh, good. Wait, is this a Fargield situation, though? Is it Goward?
Hey, did you hear that a bunch of Howard Hughes phones washed up on a beach somewhere?
I was going to say before when we were talking about those old comics that I didn't quite get as a kid. For some reason, you know how you talk about the bad feeling? For some reason, mm-hmm. that comic Shoe kind of gave me the bad feeling, if I recall, as a kid. Remember the really messy desk?
I totally agree. By the way, Andy Capp is an English comic strip created by cartoonist Reg Smythe.
Oh, yeah.
Seen in the Daily Mirror and the Sunday. This is why none of it made any sense to me as a kid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also because you were a kid and you probably didn't understand the ravages of alcoholism.
I do now.
Yeah, now it all makes sense.
Lukey Capp.
Oh, man. What should we go out with? I feel like
I was thinking maybe the Freddie Johnson song Bad Reputation.
Okay.
I don't know why. There was something that we said earlier. What do you have for show title? How about Wook Culture?
We could do Wook Culture. Or I have the Rusty Crayfish Bar and Grill.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like that too, actually.
Okay. I'll write them both down. All right, sounds good. Any story on this Freddie Johnson song?
I saw this guy play at the Backstage in Ballard, which I assume is no longer a thing. But me and my college girlfriend, Francesca Severini, she got me into this guy, and we went and saw him at the Backstage. And this particular album, I forget the name of the album, but the album that this song is off of, I just used to listen to all the time in college, and I've totally forgotten about it. And then something about Reputation came up on the show, and it made me think of the song Bad Reputation.
Can I ask you a question, actually, Luke, here? Do you mind if I extend the show by maybe two more minutes? I have a legit question for you, and it's about our former partner, Chateau Saint Michel, mm-hmm. Who do not support the show financially anymore or at this moment, but I think that there's still a lot of love there.
Sure.
And they released their summer concert lineup.
Ooh.
In fact, I wonder if our listener Jack still works for them in this capacity. But there was one thing about this that I found interesting. So they've released their summer lineup. You have Fits in the Tantrums opening things up. You got Josh Groban. I won't read them all, but you know, a lot of names that you would have heard of. And it's my understanding that tickets go on sale at 10 a.m. Monday, June 21st. Okay. Yet one of them is already sold out, and it's the John Legend.
Mm-hmm.
How is John Legend already sold out before? Is it because there's like a membership thing?
Probably, and it says rescheduled from 2020. So my guess is that it sold out in 2020, and then they just migrated the tickets over for folks.
That would make sense. I did not see that. Now I'm seeing it here, and that is exactly why. I did not see that. You know, I'll be honest, I didn't read the article. I just skipped down to the lineup, and I had seen that the tickets go on sale later, yet one of the shows was already sold out, and I was just befuddled by that. And I wasn't sure if it was like, oh, maybe if you're part of like the Chateau Saint Michel premium gold
I bet you do thing. Actually get some early. I feel like I remember us saying this on the show at some point as part of an ad. But I'm sure you do get first dibs on stuff if you are in their club. For instance, you might get first crack at seeing Train.
I saw Train. Now that I'm always confused. Isn't Train like kind of a... They weren't a Christian grunge band, were they?
No, you're thinking of Creed.
Okay,
Creed
yeah.
had heavy Christian overtones. Train does the song Drops of Jupiter.
Oh, so that's so if you what ever, we're going
I just
out
said
with.
This, I think, on the show yesterday. The best soy latte that you've ever had and me is from the song Drops of Jupiter.
Oh, no kidding. If you said that yesterday, that went totally past me.
I remember, I don't know how this info got back to me, and I didn't feel jealous or threatened, but my first wife's bachelorette party involved going to that like male strip club on like 15th.
Here
that's kind of in the Crown Hill neighborhood, and I think it used to be like... It was sort of women dancing there scantily, like six nights a week, and then one night a week it was like dudes.
Huh.
And I remember her friend Chara telling me that she had gotten a dance to the song Drops of Jupiter. Not like telling right. in a way of like, you won't believe what happened, but just mentioning right. it casually. I thought, I don't know if that's, you know, the song I get horned up to.
Right.
But
right. Yeah,
to
you
each their own.
You're not worried about the dance. You're just like, couldn't you have picked a sultrier song?
I guess a raunchier song would be more threatening to me if it was, you know, you can leave your hat on.
Oh, God.
It would be more song. Like, oh, boy, that was a real, she had a moment with that
yeah.
male entertainer.
Right.
To me, Drops of Jupiter is a deeply unsexy song.
I had a lap dance to What's Going On one time by Four Non Blondes. No, I'm just joking.
You
I
have never
no.
in your life had that experience.
I don't even fully.
I can't
I'm not,
imagine a person who would less enjoy that experience.
Yeah,
than
no, and
Andrew
I'm
Wall.
I'm still, it's funny, you know how when you're like, I don't know, like when you're a kid, you're growing up and you start mm-hmm. to hear some things that you're maybe not, you're just trying to figure things out. Nobody's totally explaining to you certain aspects of life and love and whatnot. And certain things will stick in your head because like.
Life and love and whatnot's a good show.
Write it down. I'll do it.
Right.
You know, certain things will stick in your head because you puzzled about it for so long, right? Like it never fully made sense. Like this moment in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels where Genevieve was watching that movie as a kid. And for some reason, somebody just puts on a rubber glove lasciviously, if I'm mm-hmm. using that word correctly. And she laughed, and her dad said, "Do you know why that's funny?" And she said, "I guess not." And then she just puzzled about it for years. She knew it was slightly dirty, and she knew that it was funny, but she didn't know why. And so that moment mm-hmm. stuck out to her. All of that is to say, I'm still like that with whatever happens in the back room of strip clubs because I know it's dirty and I know generally what's going on, but I don't know to what degree it's going on and what's legal and what would actually happen if somebody were to put me in that room because I don't think it would go well. I think I would just insult somebody and probably leave. I think I would be deeply, deeply uncomfortable.
I think it would make you feel very, 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 very embarrassed.
I think it would.
I remember the first time I went to one of those places, I went with my friend Peter. It was called Razzmatazz.
That's a good name.
And it was right across the street. It's basically where KEXP is now.
Oh, okay.
But that used to be this little, really crummy strip club. But I believe somehow it was like you only had to be 17 to go in there, which seems weird. Like, wow. You think that would be a state law. I remember it being the one that somehow, maybe they didn't take off all their clothes or something, I don't know. I remember being 17 and for years and years driving past Razzmatazz and thinking, when I turn 17, I'm going there. And I remember Peter and I, he had a car, he was older than me, and I think it was $5 to get in or something. We drove down to Razzmatazz and we paid our $5 and then we sat down and we were... I remember just sitting there thinking, I can't believe I am illegally allowed to observe a person who does not have their shirt on in this fashion.
While eating chicken wings.
Well, we didn't have any money for food. And by the way, they made us buy a soda that was like $7.50. And I still remember that to this day being like, God, what a rip. But I remember just sitting in there thinking like, can this be legal that I am allowed to look at this person who's not wearing a shirt right now? And it was. R.I.P. Razzmatazz.
That's a good name, though, for a
strip
club. Yeah. All right. Bad reputation. This is why you have such a bad reputation, because you were going to these dirty bird places.
Was not allowed back in Razzmatazz after a couple of incidents. Anyway. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to be back here tomorrow with more Imaginary Radio for you. So please do join us for that. Until then, have a great Wednesday. Stay safe. And please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all. And still I wanna tell you everything till I close my eyes. Suddenly I'm on the street. 7 years disappeared.
power out.